CFM 93.2 is a charity and works with the diverse communities in Bristol. So please continue to support us by getting involved and spreading the word.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Fracking in the Mendips. Is this a new source of local natural gas or a licence to poison Bristol's water supplies? We hear from Zoe Smith from Hot Wells, who's just been to court with two colleagues for trying to stop the frackers in their tracks before they get here. Plus, the latest from around the world with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, and our Palestine update. A UN report this week says conditions in occupied Palestine are becoming impossible. We have the figures and talk to a local campaigner. Also, an extract from the Iranian channel Press TV, which is now banned here in Britain. Also a special this week with a former US airman turned author who believes he's unpicked the network of dark forces which has been blighting humanity for centuries. That's a special one just before the 7 o'clock news. That's Tim Cohen, an exclusive interview. Plus the latest round the world with Martin Summers in a minute. But first of all, we're joined by Zoe Smith and Laura Caulfield, who have been involved in this local fracking campaigns. Hi, Zoe and Laura. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hello.
First of all, you, Laura, you're based in Keynsham, and I understand that in Keynsham there is going to be at least an attempt to start some fracking locally there.
That's kind of accurate. They're putting in a planning application for a test drill for coal bed methane extraction, which is very similar to fracking. It's kind of like its evil twin. It's a company called UK Methane Limited. And they got in contact to let us know that they were putting in this planning application, which is very kind of them. It's given us lots of opportunity to start our campaign, which is going really well and gaining strength day to day.
Okay, I suppose the first thing is, this is fracking is short for, is it hydraulic fracturing?
That's correct.
Right, and what is it? What is this stuff?
Well, coal bed methane is where there's a coal seam in the ground. The one in Keynsham is apparently 800 feet down, and it's when natural plants convert to being coal, the methane molecules stick to the pieces of coal and are kept there by the pressure of the water and the rocks surrounding it. And so what these companies want to do, they want to drill down to it, they want to start removing the water, which they hope will release the gas. If the gas doesn't start flowing after this point, then they start hydraulic fracturing or fracking, in which case they mix a huge amount of water with a range of chemicals and sand. They push it down the hole at great force, and this basically fractures the rock and releases the gas.
Well, that's the idea anyway. What sort of chemicals are they putting in?
All sorts of chemicals. I mean, the very first point with coal bed methane is the water that's been marinating this coal for thousands of years. It's very salinated, and it can include pollutants such as chloride, sodium, sulfate, bicarbonate, fluoride, iron, barium, magnesium, ammonia, and arsenic. So a real host of baddies that we would prefer would be to stay down there rather than risk being brought up and contaminating the water.
So, I mean, really, I mean, one argument would be, well, I mean, what's the problem with putting other chemicals into the ground when these nasty chemicals are already in there?
Well, the ones that are in there at the moment are in place, and they're not going anywhere. The problem comes from when they start to get moved around, brought to the surface, and then have to be dealt with. But, you know, they have to go somewhere once they're brought out. The problem with then doing the fracking, mixing all of the chemicals with clean water, so you're kind of irreversibly polluting this water that you then push into the ground. Some of that water never comes out. It remains in the ground with the possibility of it leaching to other places. And again, once it's done its job, it's fractured the rocks and it's been brought up, you then have to deal with it again. And then it's known as produced water, which is kind of a waste of the industry.
Okay, now before we hear from Zoe, let's have a little listen to an extract from a film called Frack Off, which has got some Brits and Americans that went over to the US to make a little film about what's been going on over there.
This is Bradford County, northeastern Pennsylvania. This previously quiet corner of America is now at the centre of a rush for natural gas, extracted through a new drilling technology called hydraulic fracturing, also known as fracking. But as the ecologist discovered, fracking is a high-risk process that threatens to both destroy the environment and wreck lives.
It makes me mad. It makes me very mad. Because my life is over without my water.
There was just like this red, nasty water just coming, just oozing out the side of the mountain, just the side of the hill.
And now hydraulic fracturing is heading for Europe. The UK, Poland, France and Germany are all next in the frack firing line.
That's an extract there from the actually quite fascinating and fairly short, not too long, YouTube film called Frack Off. Now, Zoe Smith, can you tell us what you've... Because you were in court last week. What were you in court for?
I was in court because I was arrested in December last year for scaling the drilling rig that was in place in Lancashire, another exploratory drilling site there. And we occupied the rig for, I think, 13 hours and prevented them going on with the drilling for that day at least. So I was being charged with aggravated trespass for doing that.
Okay, so this was... Just give us a description of what these drilling rigs are like that they're using to do these fracking. Because essentially, if I'm right, what they're doing is they're drilling giant holes into the ground and then stuffing stuff down and hoping that this nice natural gas is going to come up. A bit like drilling for oil or something.
It's very similar to the oil drilling process. In fact, they haven't started fracking at the site where we went. They haven't done any fracking in the last year, I think, since they had some earthquakes resulting from fracking in Lancashire.
Now, has that actually been proven? Because there was a bit of doubt about that at the time. They were this is around the Blackpool area, that there had been earthquakes, but people weren't necessarily sure if fracking had actually caused this.
There was a report from the British Geological Survey, I think, and the basic conclusion was that it was highly likely that the earthquakes were caused by fracking, and Quadrilla, which is the company involved, has also acknowledged that it was them that caused the earthquakes. They seem to have the idea that that's okay because they'll be able to monitor the earthquakes, and in that case, everything will be fine.
Oh dear, well, it sounds a little bit of a risky way of doing things. Okay, so what was it that got you particularly interested in this? Why did you decide to go up to Lancashire from Bristol and do this?
Well, we knew that the South West was also on their target list, so we felt like it was worth going up and doing the action in Lancashire just to kind of highlight the issue before they manage to come down here as well. And it's just a beautiful spot that they are turning into an industrial site. It's right next to a SSSI nature reserve at the Ribble Estuary, and it's right over one of the largest drinking water aquifers in the north of England. So they're drilling directly through the aquifer to frack beneath it, and they're claiming that a concrete pipe will be in place there, and there's no danger of that concrete pipe, earthquakes and all, fracturing and the water becoming contaminated.
Well, that sounds like sounds a little bit of a risky process, but ultimately, I mean, these companies are now on hold, aren't they, because of the earthquakes. As I understand it, the government has now said, look, you can't actually do any of this until we discover what was the cause of these earthquakes. So that is, at least there's a little bit of sensible stuff going on there, surely.
Yes, Charles Hendry from the Department of Energy and Climate Change has confirmed that fracking operations have been halted at this point, whilst they look more into it and get regulations in place. Like Zoe said, the earthquakes have been confirmed to be caused by fracking, so it's just a matter of how they feel like they can regulate it enough that they feel it's safe. I don't think it will ever be safe, and no matter how many regulations they say they can put in place and attempt to put in place, it's never worth the risk.
But Laura, how do you respond to the accusation that you're like Luddites, you're trying to stand in the way of this new technology which is actually going to bring local natural gas and possibly even bring down the price of our gas bills?
Well, it's very tricky to say it's going to bring down the price of the gas, because if problems occur, it will be the local taxpayer that will be mopping up the costs of having to clean up these messes.
So we might have to pay more council tax, but our gas bills might be cheaper.
I don't think that we're ever going to reap the benefits, and they will outweigh the environmental destruction and my hometown having to to deal with the local effects of this process. I don't think that will ever weigh it out. It's a very we've got our local MP Jacob Rees-Mogg, who said it's going to be very beneficial for the economy. The life of the drill lasts about 10-15 years. In all that time, it would have caused all these problems, and then we're going to be in exactly the same position. And that gas won't be available anymore. Fossil fuels are going to be peaking. We should be investing in renewable energy, and that's the only foolproof plan for investing in sustainable energy for everybody.
Well, it's a bit irritating to hear Jacob Rees-Mogg saying that, because not all Conservative MPs would agree with him. One of them from Field, which is up north somewhere, I'm not quite sure exactly where, Mark Menzies is a Conservative, and he pinned down, or attempted to anyway, David Cameron at Prime Minister's Questions this week on this very topic.
Mark Menzies, Mr Speaker, this government does indeed aspire to be the greenest government ever. So with that in mind, can the Prime Minister assure me that before any decision is taken to extract shale gas from Fylde, there will be both a public consultation and the establishment of an independent body to coordinate a gold standard of regulation so the environment is never compromised?
Well, as my honourable friend will know, all fracking operations for shale gas have been suspended while we study the minor tremors that occurred in Blackpool last year. The Royal Academy of Engineering and the Royal Society have produced a full independent review into the risks of fracking. But what I can assure my honourable friend about is that any future shale gas production would have to meet stringent safety and environmental standards. It would have to follow deep consultation with local communities, and it would have to fit within our overall energy commitments.
Well, that's the Prime Minister, Laura, and he's giving us some pretty strong assurances there that the proper regulations are in place.
Well, I can tell you at the moment how this fantastic public consultation he was referring to is going there at the moment. We were grateful to receive an email from UK Methane to let us know they were putting in the planning application. Since then, it's been left to the local community to organise a meeting with their geologist, paying out of our own pockets for a room to hear what he has to say. And that's kind of where it's ended, really. And it's up to us, to a community, to raise awareness with the local residents and farmers, local businesses in and all the people that live in Keynsham, to let them know what's happening, basically, and to educate ourselves. These stringent safety regulations that he's talking about do not exist at the moment. It's at the very early stages, and regardless of what he says about the fracking operations being suspended, they're pushing through with coal-bed methane at a great rate, and we really need to start being aware of it now and not be forced into this they're relaxed on it and it's all off, because it's not. It's really on, and it's up to us now to educate ourselves collectively and start fighting it.
Well, I've just pulled up an article online from the Blackpool Gazette this week, and that's where Fylde is, apparently. Chairman of Blackpool, this is Philip Mitchell, chairman of Blackpool and Fylde Green Party, and they are saying that the drilling is, in fact, it's not just them, it's also EU scientists are saying that the Environment Directorate have added its calls for tough new regulations to be imposed on the industry after a ruling it can damage the environment and people's health. This is the EU speaking here. It's not the first time a study has called for better regulation of the industry, but anti-shale gas campaigners have called on the government to take notice of this latest report. In your experience, Zoe, is this something that's happening, or is this simply an economic energy giant juggernaut that's just pushing ahead regardless?
Well, the case that I went to trial for last week proved, in fact, that Quadrilla, the company drilling, had already breached their local planning permission. They'd already been in breach of their agreement not to disturb birds overwintering in the area. So even the little regulation that they've been asked to abide by, they're ignoring. So I think juggernaut is a good word for it. They're really going all guns, because they've invested a lot of money in this and they haven't had any returns yet.
Is there actually any evidence, either of you, I'll put this to, that some of these fracking chemicals leach out and into the water supply?
Well, you just have to Google it on the internet for plenty of videos of people setting fire to their tap water. In America, from where methane has escaped from the fractures into the local water, and there's plenty of footage of dead ecology and water bubbling up through brooks, methane, sorry, bubbling up through brooks. The evidence is out there. You don't have to scratch the surface very hard to see it.
I mean, we're in the situation, though. I mean, we were hearing that the regulations are supposed to be in place. They're being broken by these companies, and very little seems to be being done about it. Are we in a situation where the only way to stop this is for people to literally go in there and physically either break the materials that are being, or the drilling rigs and this kind of thing? Seems to be impossibly the only way to actually get this stopped. At the moment, it has stopped, but it's going to be starting again soon, isn't it?
Well, in Transition Cainshan, we're attempting to do the legal route. We're attempting to contact our, you know, elected representatives. And, you know, we've started to collect a petition. We've been told by our local councillors that petitions aren't worth, you know, the paper they're written on, that they'll only be counted as one objection, even though there might be thousands of names on there. So you're constantly kind of having to jump over these hurdles. But at the moment, we have some faith that perhaps this method will work. And we would urge people out there to sign our petition, which you can find on the Frack Free Somerset website. And we will be attending planning meetings and opposing planning applications, and we urge people to support us in doing that. But who knows? You know, it's that, and it's literally a life and death situation. If they come to my hometown and they attend, you know, attempt to go through with these operations, I don't know what I'll be left with. You know, it will be my children's home, and several generations after that, they'll be dealing with these consequences, and I don't know what I will be forced to do.
Yeah, Zoe, the films that Laura was talking about there are pretty appalling when you see them. The idea that you have to be very careful in your kitchen if your cooker is too close to the sink, in case you put the tap on and the whole sink catches fire. This isn't ideal, really, is it?
Yes, and not only that, people's animals are dying, people themselves are suffering from ill health, their hair is falling out, they have headaches, stomach upsets. This whole area is being contaminated in America and Australia particularly. What we're finding in Europe is that fracking is being much more closely watched because we're a much more closely packed population, and there just isn't space to go about drilling holes around people's homes, and there are many more people who would suffer the consequences of that should they get away with it.
Now, we've got this organisation called Frack Free Somerset, Laura. How do people sort of keep in touch with what's going on locally?
Well, the coalition came about because some licences, PEDL licences, were bought by coal gas companies for the Mendips area, which also includes Cainshan. So it was a group of us concerned people that felt like we wanted to get together and have a united voice, share resources and plan events so that people could raise awareness about it. So we've got a website, which is www.frackfreesomerset.org.uk, and people can sign up for action alerts and be kept informed about local news and find out where events are happening, and find details about how, you know, there's letter templates on there, so people can write, you know, feel empowered to write letters to their local councillors if they've not done that sort of thing before. We really need everybody to get on board with this.
Okay, so that's frackfreesomerset.org. Now, I understand, isn't there some sort of talk coming up in Wales at some point in the near future, or have we just missed it?
No, it's on Tuesday the 25th of September from 7 till 9 p.m. at the Wales Town Hall, and we've just had it confirmed that the director of UK Methane will be on our question and answer panel. So the event is an opportunity for people to hear both sides of the story. We don't want to be accused of being scaremongering. We want to have all the facts laid out on the table and have opportunities to speak to these people so that people can be informed and make their own decisions. Mainly because we're confident once they hear the facts that they'll be appalled and they won't want it to happen. We've got nothing to hide. So yes, people are welcome to come along to this event and ask questions to the panel.
Well, it'd be interesting, certainly an interesting thing to come along to, and also an interesting test of whether we live in a democracy or not.
Indeed. We've invited several people from lots of different stakeholders, Wessex Water, the Environment Agency. We're really trying to get everybody that will be affected by these decisions on board. And it will also be filmed for those of you that can't make it on the night.
Lovely. Well, that's Laura Caulfield from Cainshan and Frack Free Somerset, and Zoe Smith from Rising Tide. Thank you ever so much for being here this
Thanks
evening.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
rivers of Babylon. There we sat down. There we wept when we remembered Zion. By the rivers of Babylon. There we sat down. There we wept when we remembered.
Well, the ubiquitous Boney M there from many years ago with rather nicer water than the kind of nasty red stuff pouring out the side of that mountain in America after the frackers had had a go at it. Now we have a little look around some of the world's news stories with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Martin, one of the biggies this week, quite clearly, is the US embassy being attacked in Yemen, other embassies in Egypt, and the Libya envoy, that is the actual ambassador to Libya, killed. So what are your thoughts on this piece of news?
Well, it's obviously developing as we speak, and it's not quite clear what's happened after Friday prayers today across the Muslim world. I mean, obviously, this film is—it's turning out that there isn't actually a film. I've been reading on the internet that the video clip is all there is, and that in actual fact it's dubbed, and that the people who were the actors have come forward and said, "Well, that we were acting something, but it was nothing like that." And somebody's just dubbed all of this anti-Muslim propaganda over there.
I took the trouble to sit and watch the trailer of it. It's pretty hideous stuff, actually, rather disgusting, and also reminiscent of the sort of dirty kind of the Manson films from the 90s. 1960s and 70s, done by amateurs out in the middle of nowhere. Just the idea designed to sort of provoke people.
Well,
really.
Obviously, whoever's done it is deliberately designing to provoke people and create fear and division.
Well, one of the interesting
the question is it just a freelance operation, or is it another part of a false flag psychological warfare exercise designed, for example, to create hostility between America and Muslims to the benefit, perhaps, of the Israelis? We don't know.
But
we've got to ask the questions. It may be that all of this stuff is not just a series of random events. It is part of a strategy of tension, being with strings being pulled by some intelligence service, and we can all guess who those might be.
Well, the BBC line I found particularly interesting. On every news bulletin, they were saying that this film is said to insult Islam. Well, it clearly does insult Islam, so why would they be saying that?
Well, listen, BBC guidelines on things like this are a mystery to all of us. But, I mean, the real issue here is that somebody would be really problematic if it was just a group of discontented ne'er-do-well losers. That would be bad enough, but if there is an intelligence service fingerprint behind all of this, and if you remember back to the Danish magazine showing the cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad, it was fairly clear evidence that was an intelligence service plant in order to create division. Don't forget, some people have got a vested interest in a clash of civilizations. That allows wars to be declared, countries to be occupied, oil to be secured. And some people are looking to create those kind of tensions. And it's not just they're building, of course, on popular prejudices, but it's not that. What I worry about is that, just like the Breivik attack in Norway and all the rest of it, we are being subjected to a psychological warfare operation. Extremist Muslims are the puppets at one end, and we know Al-Qaeda, for example, are being armed and trained by the CIA in Syria, in Turkey, being pushed into Syria. At the same time, we've got these so-called extremist Christians who are discrediting Christianity by the kind of things they're saying. And of course...
Would you call Mr. Tony Blair and George Bush extremist Christians?
I'm talking about Terry Jones, the pastor in the US, who's been instrumental in burning the Quran and other sorts of ridiculous stunts like that. But this is incredibly dangerous. It's playing with fire, and I suspect that what we're seeing here is all the psychological warfare tricks being pulled in order to push us towards war with Syria and Iran, which we could be in before Christmas, speaking of Christians.
Now, the Al-Hilli conundrum. This is a posting by Craig Murray, the former Uzbekistan ambassador, his blog this week on the shootings in France. This is the Al-Hilli family. Now, various bits and pieces have come out about him. He was a software engineer working for a defence company. It looks like on mapping satellites. Now, the mapping satellites are also very useful when it comes to things like targeting and tracking. So linking in slightly with possibly with the drones and this kind of thing. Now, what are your thoughts about this one? Because there is, we're getting lines from the British police and the French police both saying, oh, it's nothing to do with us, it must be the other guys. And we're also being given all sorts of sort of indications that suspicious stuff has been found at his house here in Britain, and then nothing's found. What seems to be behind this? Because it certainly looks like a professional contract killing.
Absolutely professional contract killing, there's no doubt about that. If people go to Craig Murray's website, they will see his speculations about this, and he has got contacts in the intelligence services. Apparently, the French cyclist was also a senior scientist and engineer, and the suggestion is that they may have been having a meeting, perhaps to do some kind of deal, and that somebody came along and executed everybody concerned. Now, I don't know whether that's true, but there are various factors in this this killing which don't add up.
And just to give some detail to that, Sylvain Mollier, the passing cyclist, was in fact a nuclear metallurgist who worked for a French nuclear company called Cesus, a subsidiary of Areva, who fabricate and process zirconium into metal and nuclear-grade zircoalloy for nuclear fuel assemblies. Well, isn't it an interesting coincidence they just happened to be hanging around?
And also, the chap who was assassinated, he was a Shia Muslim, and he had been to Iran for pilgrimages. Now, it may be that what we've got here is a Mossad hit on scientists associated with the Iranian nuclear program, as we've seen inside Iran. That may be what's going on. I wouldn't like to speculate.
Craig's own security service contacts apparently insist that Al-Hilli was not a person of any current interest to the UK intelligence services and not involved in anything clandestine. He goes on to say, what is the probability that two highly skilled engineers managed to be at the same remote place at the same time, yet still managed to end up dead as a result of what looks like to be a military-style assassination. As someone else pointed out in the Independent comments, the deceased were found by a retired RAF officer who we assume will receive perpetual anonymity as a witness. Potentially, maybe not. But anyway, if the police are looking for a motive, why don't they try an intercepted rendezvous by a security service fixated on denying a hostile power illicit nuclear technology?
Well, that's the point I've just made. I mean, Craig is speculating that this is a Mossad hit in order to hit Iran's nuclear program. And let's be absolutely clear about this. The Israelis are, and Western intelligence services are, tramping the globe, carrying out assassinations in our name to stop supposedly the Iranian nuclear program, for which evidence is very, very thin that they actually have one. The fact of the matter is that the Western powers are terrorist suspects, and they have been for many, many years.
We've had the 9/11 anniversary this week, and one of the news stories, I actually did a search for this on the various news websites, and nobody in the entire English language Western world media picked up on the fact that the President of Italy's Supreme Court is going to refer the 9/11 crimes to the International Criminal Court. This is Fernando Imposimato, the Honorary President of the Supreme Court of Italy and a former senior investigative judge.
Yes, and I presume he's referring to the US government rather than, there's been a ridiculous court case in the US where a US judge has declared that Iran is responsible for 9/11.
Well, he's not a spread of what he's saying is that 9/11 was just like the strategy of tension which was carried out in Italy in the 1980s. What does he mean by that?
The strategy of detenzione was carried out by the intelligence services in Italy, backed up by the British and the Americans. It involved assassinations, bombings, the most notorious being the bombing of Bologna railway station in 1980 that killed 86 people, and also the kidnap of the then Prime Minister of Italy, Aldo Moro, blamed on the Red Brigades, but Red Brigades by that stage had become an arm of the state. All of which is not conspiracy theory. It's absolutely known to be historical fact through various investigations that have been carried out. Italians are much more aware of the criminality of the state than people in Middle England who don't know much.
Another story, Arab Lawyers Union is condemning a decision on stopping Iran's TVs as illegal. This is from the Syrian English language news service Sana, which is sometimes, it seems, is not available due to cyber attacks, and other times is. It's a bit hit and miss. But anyway, you can go to Sana online to find them, S-A-N-A, Syrian Arab News Agency. The Arab Lawyers Union have condemned the Arab Foreign Minister's Council's decision to stop broadcasting Syrian TV channels on the Arab satellites as illegal and illegitimate.
Well, it's all part of the psychological warfare that's going on around us. Basically, the control of the information flow is part of warfighting strategy now. So if people actually read properly what's been going on, they will find out that the various massacres that were supposedly carried out by the Assad regime actually have been carried out by the rebels and then blamed on the Assad regime. And no doubt they've been told to do that by their psychological warfare handlers from the British and US special forces. So you see what the game is. You kill supporters of the regime in Syria, then they can't say anything. And you show the bodies to the press and say, ooh, the horrible government did this. And so you get a double whammy. You kill your opponents and you blacken the name of the regime. Now, of course, I'm not saying that the Syrian regime isn't capable of similar actions. We're in a mess. Everybody's doing these nasty things.
Well, also on a similar topic, with another channel that's banned is the Iranian channel, Press TV. And every time, whenever I can, I try and put some of their broadcasts on here, simply because it's been banned by Ofcom. And here we have, from last week, Gordon Duff from Veterans Today. And he asks the question, will Israel attack Iran? Maybe, Martin, just in a nutshell, you can tell us what you think before we hear from Gordon Duff.
I think one way or the other, we're going to war.
In actuality, Israel's military is far less robust than they claim. Over 50% of their attempted draftees dodge military service. Their fighter aircraft are at great risk over Iran, even though Iran has not received the S-300 air defense system that Russia had promised years ago. They have no way of reaching Iran whatsoever without traveling over either Iraq, attacking from Azerbaijan, where it is believed that they have secret facilities, or flying across Saudi Arabia. All of those countries, were they complicit in an attack on Iran, would suffer dire consequences. Israel is saber-rattling because Netanyahu is at extremely low popularity. Israel primarily is involved in trying to get Mitt Romney, a puppet of American organized crime, who had just traveled to Israel with gambling boss Sheldon Adelson, and they want Mitt Romney in. It has very little to do with Iran. It has very much to do with taking down world currencies. Iran may be a victim, may be held up as a target, but Israel's own problem, and of course the ability to misuse and milk the United States financially dry, is a primary goal of Israel. Their control in Washington over some aspects of government is complete. Their control over the Obama White House currently is non-existent.
Well, that's something that you won't be seeing on your TV screen because it's banned in Britain. That's Press TV. Gordon Duff there from Veterans Today speaking. Martin, he's talking about Mitt Romney. There is a puppet of US organised crime. And he's saying really one of the only parts of the American government which is not controlled by the Israelis, I mean, whether that's true or not is another here or there, is the White House.
Well, Gordon Duff, people should look up his stuff on Veterans Today. Veterans Today is a very interesting magazine. It's basically produced by ex-US military veterans, and Gordon Duff served in Vietnam. I listen always to what Gordon says because he's got plenty of contacts on the inside who give him information. But a lot of what he comes out with is just his opinion, and you know, I listen, but I don't necessarily.
The point being, it's banned here. You're not allowed to see it now.
Oh, indeed. I mean, that is absurd. People really need to hear these things because we are sliding down the road to a banking collapse and a world war, and it's time people were given the full range of opinions about what's going on.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, the local Palestine Solidarity Campaign is a representative from there is along here this evening. That's Rita Kangalusi. Is that how you pronounce it, Rita?
Yeah.
Rita, can you just give us an idea of what's been going on recently over in Palestine and what's happening here in Bristol?
Yeah, it's actually no reason. It's about in April start of this Palestinian detainee in an Israeli prison being there without charge. So they started anger strike and just to raise their voice.
Okay, so but then there's also, you've got a petition that you're running at the moment.
Yes, it's the petition. This guy is actually, it's called Save Amir. Shakir Amir campaign. He's a Londoner as well. He's been to prison in Guantanamo Bay for the last 10 years without charge. So his, the petition is just to, we need 100,000 signatures to let him come back home. He haven't done anything.
Now, one of the things that the Israelis always say is, well, since they put the wall up in between Israel and Palestine, which is supposed to be the same country, but effectively it's two different countries now, there's been a great reduction in the number of the attacks within the Israeli part of that. So they see that wall as a success story.
Exactly, they see that war. This is what they say. What we see is just like the suffering of the Palestinians on Gaza strips, and children being arrested, being tortured, being beat up, being signed. They let them sign paper which they don't even understand the language. And these other people are young, well, adult, they are in prison. And to raise their voice, just go to hunger strike. They don't eat anymore. And one guy is 139 days. And basically, his father said, dignity and freedom are more precious than food. Back in May, the BBC said that Israeli and Palestinian make an agreement such as the relatives can go visit them in prison, or maybe they have a TV in the room, and as long as they don't have any terrorist activity inside the Israeli prison, even though these Palestinians haven't done anything, they haven't had any charge. They're just there waiting for make a decision. And one guy actually spent 36 years in an Israeli prison never been charged.
Well, this week the United Nations has stepped into the fray. UNCTAD agency, that's the UN Conference on Trade and Development, issued a gloomy outlook for the Palestinian economy, arguing that tougher Israeli policies were pushing the Palestinian territories in Gaza deeper and deeper into poverty. The economy apparently in Palestine has lost access to 40% of West Bank land and 82% of its groundwater and more than two-thirds of its grazing land. Shepherds in the West Bank have lost a large portion of lands where their animals used to graze because of the Israeli barrier. This barrier, the UN says, affects our grazing lands as we used to go behind in those mountains where there are good places for grazing. We used to have double and treble the number of sheep, but we can't graze. Towns like Bethlehem and surrounding villages in the West Bank are heavily reliant on farmland. The study, which draws on information from the UN Office for the Coordination of Human Affairs, states that 50 to 75% of agricultural land traditionally used by people of the Bethlehem municipality has been confiscated through the constructions of Israel's barrier and settlement building. Just tell us, can you give us an idea, Rita, of what goes on here in Bristol, because people do get together as part of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, don't they?
Yeah, well, what I do personally, I do the boycott. I mean, to boycott campaign. So I boycott everything come from Israel, all they produce, and some of the company used to be like Agresco. They changed name. Now people are really confused where products come from Israel and where. You have to actually read the label every time and make sure you don't buy anything that comes from Israel. Even though we're not actually financially damaged them, consider that America given 90% of the welfare only to Israel, the rest 10% to the rest of the world. So basically, it's just to raise the profile for the Palestinian. So basically, it's important that people stop by product from Israel, because Gaza Strip is actually a concentration camp.
Well, that's an interesting way of putting it, with that wall around it. Whereabouts and when do you meet here in Bristol?
We meet in Hamilton House on the last Tuesday of the month about 7 o'clock.
Okay, that's lovely. Rita Kangalusi, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Another thing, people can see news on a Palestinian Solidarity Campaign website, and Bristol got their own website.
Lovely. All right, thanks very much.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Yes, we've all heard of the dark forces, but what are they? David Kelly, the government scientist found dead in the woods in 2003, talked of the dark actors playing games. Even the Queen famously addressed the royal butler Paul Burrell, saying there are forces in this country which we have no knowledge. Well, in identifying these forces, we know how interesting, and actually one person who's done it, we've got the internet, haven't we, to do that sort of thing, and former US Airman and author Tim Cohen has his point of view too, and I'll give you the name of his book after we've heard from him.
Yeah, I was a cadet at the Air Force Academy, class of 88, became a Christian while at the Academy, after having read through the Bible, most of it. A few times I asked God to show me who and what was being spoken of in Revelation 13, which is a passage having to do with the Antichrist. And shortly thereafter, the Lord led me to information concerning Prince Charles, and that led to the book. I had no knowledge, actually, of the British monarchy or European power structures to speak of at the time. After I asked God to show me this information, I encountered a pastor in Colorado Springs who had a copy of the unofficial version of Prince Charles' coat of arms, as well as an English name calculation produced through a computer program. And I went back and I thought, well, that's interesting. And so I looked around at the cadet library for books on heraldry and happened to find at that time the one book in the world that actually had Prince Charles' official heraldic achievement or coat of arms. And from there, just began to research it. Ended up being kind of top-down research, and I discovered all the other material that led to the book in the course of doing that. At the same time, I was writing another series that I began while at Cadets of the Academy that is still to be completed, and that's called Messiah History in the Tribulation Period, which effectively deals with the rest of Scripture other than the identity of the Antichrist. So I've worked on a lot of things, and now the second edition of the Antichrist and the Cup of Tea is coming to fruition in the near future, and after that, the first edition of that, Messiah History in the Tribulation Period. So that's where it is, and there's actually a huge amount of information and evidence to suggest that Prince Charles is, in fact, the individual foretold in Revelation 13 to be the Antichrist, who will have control effectively over what amounts to global government prior to Christ's return.
Heraldry is a bit of a weird one. There's a lot of symbolism in there. Can you just pull out a couple of symbols for us?
Symbolism has been used throughout history to represent nations, individuals, businesses, armies, combatants in war, for example. And that symbolism was formalized in a series of heraldic symbols historically within the United Kingdom, Europe, and elsewhere in the world. And there are actually international laws today that apply to heraldry and what you can legally assign to an individual or an entity. And in terms of Prince Charles' coat of arms, it's somewhat like a genetic code in the sense that they've taken symbols from each of his parents, that being Queen Elizabeth II and Prince Philip's coats of arms, combined them and then added unique symbols for the prince. So on his coat of arms, we would find, as an example, a lion, leopard, bear, beast, in place of what would normally be a lion or a lion leopard for England. We find a unicorn that has human eyes, which is unusual, though not totally unique in heraldry, and that would normally represent Scotland. We find the red dragon, which today represents Wales. It was adopted as the national symbol of Wales in 1958, somewhat like the United States has the eagle or its national symbol. We find other symbols related to the Black Prince or the founding Prince of Wales of the Order of the Garter on Prince Charles' coat of arms. And together these represent the United Kingdom in, you know, typical heraldic understanding. However, that particular red dragon that's on his coat of arms actually traces back to the Roman Empire, and specifically the Roman cohorts that occupied ancient Britannia, and prior to that, that occupied ancient Judea. So it happens to be the same red dragon, spoken of in Revelation 12 and 13, that historically represented Satan, scripturally speaking. The lion, leopard, bear, beast that's on Prince Charles' coat of arms is completely unique to him historically. That beast, along with the red dragon, are not found, for example, on William's and Harry's coats of arms. So those things could be called together the calling card, if you will, of the Antichrist. In Revelation 13, we read that there is a beast with feet like a bear, body like a leopard, mouth like a lion, that rises up out of the sea, and that the dragon of Revelation 12, the prior chapter, the fiery red dragon, gives this beast his seat, throne, and great authority, and that this beast is a man, and that the number of his name is 666. So that would be one place to start with regard to Prince Charles, and all of that is, of course, detailed even in the first edition of the Antichrist and the Capitee that was published in 98.
What do you say about these orders, these knightly orders like the Order of the Garter, and how they interrelate with each other?
Well, there are a variety of orders of knighthood historically, some of which continue to exist today. The oldest existing order of knighthood is the Order of the Garter. The oldest continuously existing order was founded in 1348 by King Edward and his son, known as Edward the Black Prince. And at the time of its founding, it had symbolism, specifically the garter, that was related to a witch, the Countess of Salisbury. The garter itself today is encircled by a row of buckles that are quite small, but if you get a good detailed photo of the garter, they're noticeable. And those are horseshoe-shaped buckles. There are two rows of 169 each lining the edges of the garter, 13 times 13. And those buckles in witchcraft and Wicca each represent of themselves a coven of 13 witches. So in a sense, it's a coven of covens of covens. 13 times 13 times 13. And what that represents in Wicca is a witch king of witch kings or a witch queen of witch queens. Now that is one aspect, one of several aspects of the occult origins that are associated with the Order of the Garter. And that order has, by birth, two highest-ranking knights, and that would be the Prince of Wales of the day and the British monarch of the day. So today that would be Prince Charles and Queen Elizabeth II. And because Prince Charles is a male, he often takes precedence, actually, over the Queen in the order itself. With that said, the Order of the Garter historically became the core leadership, encompassed the core leadership of the Priory of Zion, the Knights Templar, the Rosicrucians, Freemasonry, the modern Illuminati, a lot of other organizations that we know today as the modern international banking concern, insurance concern, television media, all these things tie into the Order of the Garter and something called the Committee of 300, also under the British monarchy. So there are these, and there are other orders of knighthood that Prince Charles and other British royals are part of. They all have effectively served as a long-term venue for establishing a kind of global control under the British monarchy, and ultimately that is leading to what many refer to as the New World Order or the coming global government under the Antichrist, etc.
The actual translation of this, though, into politics, the European Union, for example, is a very powerful political organization, and that surely is not linked to Charles or the Order of the Garter.
In fact, it is. So to give you some concrete examples of that, the Order of the Garter itself has 12 companion knights for the British monarch and another 12 companion knights for the Prince of Wales of the day, and extra knights have been added beyond that in more recent history. And those knights have typically been members of other royal houses of Europe, other major royal houses in the world. So, for example, Spain's king is a knight in the Order of the Garter beneath Prince Charles and Queen Elizabeth II. Japan's Emperor Hirohito in World War II was a knight in the Order of the Garter. Hirohito was kicked out of the order during World War II and brought back in after the war. Today, his descendant is a knight in the Order of the Garter. But the point is, for these other royal houses to be part of the Order of the Garter beneath the British monarchy is in effect signifying that the British monarch is over them. And when we talk about politics and so forth, we have in the Royal House of England what is effectively a German, French, and English monarchy, besides Greek. So the House of Windsor was known as the House of Saxe-Coburg-Gotha a century ago, and because of World War I, they changed their name to the House of Windsor. But it is effectively the monarchy of multiple nations, or those nations to reinstate a monarchy, and you have what today amounts to a unified diplomatic mission between Germany, France, and England under the foreign minister of the European Union, who is now a British Baroness, who reports to Prince Charles, Baroness Ashton, Catherine Ashton. She is the foreign minister of the EU today, effectively reports to Prince Charles because she is a baroness. You know, when we talk about the Middle East peace process with the Palestinians and the nations of the world, you have the quartet, which is the successor, if you will, to the Oslo process. So the quartet and the roadmap are where it sits today in terms of the false peace process. And the quartet itself is comprised of four members, the United States, Russia, the European Union, and the United Nations, and because the UN is in there, it's effectively all the nations of the world. Tony Blair, who still reports, in a sense, to Prince Charles, former Prime Minister, is the special envoy to this day for the quartet. Shimon Peres, in 2008, I believe it was knighted by the British monarchy. He's the president of Israel, and has been involved since, even before the Madrid peace talks, going all the way back to the London area of 1987 in the false peace efforts. And he's Israel's president long-term, has been for quite a while, on and off. Then you have, besides that, of course, the United Nations, which came out of the League of Nations, which is tied into Chatham House, or the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London, which is under Prince Charles today. So you have multiple prongs, if you will, for this false peace effort that all tie back to Prince Charles, even Barack Obama. Obama's father, if he was Barack Hussein Sr., his father was a British citizen, a dual citizen, at the time that Obama was born, making Obama a British citizen by birth, which is part of the controversy here in the United States about whether he's even constitutionally president of the United States, whether he's legally president. But the fact of the matter is, he might be a British citizen. He did meet with Prince Charles on multiple occasions following his election in 2008. In fact, they all surrounded, actually, is visit to Cairo, Egypt, to speak to the Muslim world from the same university where Prince Charles received an honorary doctorate in Islam. So there's much more to Prince Charles and the British monarchy than meets the eye, even now. And these things, many of them have been brought out in the first edition of my book, and the second edition, they'll be even more.
Now, you casually threw in this whole concept, the Illuminati. Do you actually have any evidence, though, Tim, that this still exists? I mean, it was a big scandal back in the late 1700s, but what evidence, if any, is there that such an organisation exists today?
There's actually a great deal of evidence. Historically, the modern Illuminati was supposedly founded by Adam Weishaupt, funded by the Rothschilds. However, many people are aware of the fact that the symbol of the Illuminati is viewed as a pyramid with the all-seeing eye. It's actually an ancient symbol, predates the Illuminati. It is a parody, if you will, of Christ in the New Jerusalem, with the New Jerusalem being a giant pyramid, and Christ, the God-King, who will rule from the New Jerusalem at the end of his millennial reign when we have the new heavens and new earth. So the symbol that the Illuminati still use to this day, a primary symbol, is the pyramid with the all-seeing eye, with their counterfeit version of God, their counterfeit version of the Messiah. And that symbol is seen throughout architecture in the Western world. One doesn't have to look very far to see it used and mimicked repeatedly in technology products, in architecture in the Western world and elsewhere. What these people do is often under the surface, and the symbolism is there to be recognized by those who understand what's actually occurring. The rest of the public is blind to it. So, to me, that's one indication that these folks are, in fact, still around. The first edition is titled The Antichrist and a Cup of Tea. Yeah, the second edition is The Antichrist and a Cup of Tea, Charles, Prince of Wales, Foretold. That's got a subtitle. Within the next 6 months, should be off the press.
That was Tim Cohen there, and his book is called The Antichrist and a Cup of Tea. Next week, Norwegian neo-Nazi killer Anders Breivik. We take a look at the network surrounding him, its funding, his visits to Britain, and how Breivik boasted of helping to found the English Defence League. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend.
Well, big enough for the fresh blood crew, yes. I'm Mr. Ratchet Man, I pass through. To let everybody know, sir.